From Aspen Public Radio, this is Curated, stories on the art and the artists who visit and live in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It is Monday, June 12th, and now we're just days away from the kickoff to the 35th annual Food and Wine Classic in Aspen, one of the biggest weekends of the summer, and I have a confession to make. I do not consider myself a foodie. I mean, don't take that as I don't eat. I totally eat. And I have my favorite dishes, like the day-old pizza I ate for breakfast this morning while writing this script. So maybe don't think of me as the expert guiding you through today's show. Think of me as a guinea pig, ready but hesitant to try new things. On this week's program, a local food writer swoops in to save the day, helping me overcome my deep-seated foodie self-doubt. We'll hear from one of Food & Wine's 2017 Best New Chefs and ignite the fire pits for locally sourced meats. Plus, music from a veteran DC-based reggae band coming to Fanny Hill, and details on other cultural events happening this week in the Valley. Thanks for tuning in, and stay with me. So this is obviously my first Food & Wine Classic. Can you tell? Joining us to provide more details is local food columnist Amanda Ray. She has so much cred, writing for Aspen Times Weekly, Aspen Sojourner Magazine, Aspen Luxury Life Magazine, and Edible Aspen. She joins me now from the APR studios.
Hello, Claire.
Expert foodie. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks. Okay, so for those like me who don't consider themselves foodies, What is Food and Wine and what's going to be happening this weekend?
So the Food and Wine Classic in Aspen, as the name suggests, is the annual festival that draws chefs, winemakers, purveyors, and all sorts of other people in the food industry for a three-day festival of food and wine. So there's grand tastings, seminars, parties around town. A lot of the chefs call it summer camp because it's sort of a reunion when they're able to all meet in one place. And Aspen is a beautiful backdrop for that.
Oh, no way.
This year is the 35th anniversary. Kind of a big year. The festival was started back in Snowmass in 1982, and it was a much smaller gathering by some local restaurateurs. And now it's grown to 5,000 people attend every year. So attendance is capped at 5,000 people now. Food and Wine magazine came on board a few years after it started in Snowmass, and that has boosted the event to this internationally known festival of food.
Wow. So I think it's safe for me to assume that there are more than 5,000 people that want to attend this.
Yes. Well, that's the interesting part. So they sell 5,000 tickets, which normally sell out in early spring, but most of the hotels are almost at full capacity, and some estimates have placed visitors to Aspen during that time around like 10 or 15,000. So I think that just goes to show that there's a lot more happening outside of the classic proper. So if you didn't get a pass or you don't have tickets to the event, there are a lot of other things going on at local restaurants and galleries and other venues throughout Aspen for the weekend.
Cool. So you've been writing about food in Aspen for like 5 years now.
Yeah.
So you must have a sense of where the locals go that didn't get into that top 5,000.
Definitely all of the parties that are happening at the various restaurants and other places in town. There's some private parties that happen at private homes in the area. Those are mostly by word of mouth, invite only, that sort of thing. For instance, Jimmy's restaurant is celebrating its 20th anniversary this summer. So he's having, you know, a big invite only party, and there's some other things going on at the local restaurants too.
Awesome. So in addition to all of the locals that did happen to get passes, There are a ton of foodie tourists that come into Aspen literally just for this event. What are some of the trends you've seen over the years with the different tourists that come into town for this?
Well, I think just as anywhere, Instagram and social media play such a big role in the American foodie culture. And what's interesting, living in a small place like Aspen, I think we might be shielded from outside influences maybe a little bit more than, say, if you lived in like a New York City or San Francisco. So you have these international cosmopolitan tourists coming here, bringing all of those influences from wherever they're from. Everyone's obsessed with documenting their lives, you know, via Instagram. And food is such an important part of our lives that that's, you know, a natural part of Instagram at this point. So you're in a restaurant with a bunch of people and you normally see everyone break their phones out and take pictures of their dishes and the food sitting there getting cold. And I've talked to a lot of chefs throughout my work, and some chefs, there's two ways to think of it. Some chefs really enjoy like the free marketing because these posts, you know, can garner a lot of attention. But then other chefs think that it distracts from the dining experience. So, you know, some major chefs in bigger cities have actually banned cameras or at least flash photography in the dining room.
Isn't it a thing where waiters and bartenders have noticed that with the ability to like pull our phones out and take pictures of our food, it takes longer to get people through the dining experience?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you'll see people sitting there with their phones out trying to get the right angle, arranging things just so on the plate.
The right filter.
Yeah. And then actually going through and writing the post, creating the hashtags and doing all of this before they've even had a bite of the food. And what's funny is that, you know, sometimes you'll see people post these pictures of these dishes before they've even had a chance to try them to know if they're good or bad.
Or like, what if it gets cold or...
Well, that too. Same thing.
So... In the past 5 years that you've been here documenting this intense foodie culture that Aspen seems to have, mm-hmm. What have you learned from your experience?
Well, pacing is very important. You know, we are at altitude, and even if you live here, it can become a little bit overwhelming because there's so much food, there's so much wine, there's so much booze, and it's really easy to get carried away, especially if you're hopping from party to party. So, of course, you know, the old standby, drink water, pace yourself, that sort of thing. But then also, I would suggest just accept that you're not going to be able to fit everything into your schedule. Don't try and plan too much either. I think part of the magic of the Food and Wine Classic in Aspen is seeing where the day takes you, because you will end up running into people, having some great conversation with lots of like-minded foodies out there, and you'll want to remain open to be able to go on a food adventure.
But maybe, like, don't be looking at your phone the entire time trying to just take pictures and, like, live in the moment.
Yeah, I think for me personally, I've sort of experienced this backlash to the whole social media crush. So when I'm out at a restaurant, you know, I do take pictures of the food because that's also part of my job.
It's part of your job.
but yes, try and stay off your phones, because if your head is focused on a screen, you're not open and able to meet people who are walking around. And that's really the joy of the weekend.
Yeah. So what are you most excited about this upcoming festival?
Well, Heritage Fire in Snowmass on Saturday. That is always my favorite event. It's been going on for, I think this is the third year now. More than 30 chefs are invited to build live fire pits on Fanny Hill. And they have to construct the structure on which they cook these heritage breed animals. And it's a whole animal live fire cookery. And it's super exciting. It's just a smorgasbord of meat and other foods, wine, cocktails, and it's all outside in Snowmass. That is always a really fun time. I'm also excited for Mark Oldman's wine seminars. He's a wine expert and entrepreneur, and he's published a few books. And this year, his seminar, Wine for Zillionaires, which will focus on like some of the priciest wines in the world. And unlike some of the other seminars, everything in his seminars, and maybe in most of the wine seminars, offer samples to the participants. So you get to actually try these wines, which is really exciting.
You get to actually try the wines for zillionaires.
Wines for zillionaires. He's pouring a handful of wines for this seminar, and I think he said that the total cost, if you were to buy a bottle of each of the wines, would have been more than $9,500. So these are, you know, pours that you wouldn't be able to taste really anywhere else. So.
Can you describe like what my face looks like right now?
You look dumbfounded.
It's true.
Total shock. I'm also looking forward to a seminar with a local cheese expert. She's a part-time Aspenite, Laura Worland. And she's hosting a seminar with Bobby Stuckey, who is a legendary sommelier who came out of the Little Nell back in the 90s and has now risen up through the wine world. And they are pairing cheese and wine.
And what if you have like a dietary restriction going into this festival? Like you're a vegetarian or a pescatarian.
Don't
or
go. No, but seriously. Just ask questions. I guess that's all you can really do is just make sure that you ask questions about what's in the different foods, especially if you go to a grand tasting, because that's where they have the samples of foods at different booths from all sorts of restaurants and restaurateurs and chefs and purveyors.
And that's where all of the best new chefs are going to be.
Yes, they actually have their own corner of one of the tents. And this all happens in Wagner Park. So it's a beautiful setting. The tents actually went up yesterday, so they're already in place and everyone's getting super excited
awesome.
Around town for it. Like the big takeaway for me after every Food and Wine Classic in Aspen is that food has this power to pull people together, and it's just such a great community event. And I know a lot of people grumble about the ticket prices being steep and limited, but there's a lot more to the weekend than just the grand tastings and the seminars. You know, there's a lot of other things happening. All of the local restaurants piggyback on this event, and the chefs get really excited about it and host parties and whatnot. And, you know, like you said, you don't consider yourself a foodie, but in a way, everyone should consider themselves foodies because we all have to eat, right? It's something that we all have in common. Food is something that we all have in common.
Totally. Awesome. Well, maybe I will be able to call myself a foodie after this coming weekend.
Absolutely. Yeah, get out there and explore. That's all you can do is get out, explore, keep your eyes open, stay off your phone, and just be open to meeting people and have conversations and ask questions.
Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. That was Amanda Ray, a seasoned food writer in Aspen, helping me to overcome my foodie anxiety. Now we're going to fly to New York, my home state, for a fresh perspective on the most American of foods, red meat from one of this year's best new chefs from the Food and Wine Classic. Meet Angie Marr, owner and chef of New York's The Beatrice Inn. On cooking meats, she says it's not an art, but a craft.
Growing up, I was always pretty much eating meat, which I think is kind of indicative to my taste today. I definitely come from a big food family. You know, my aunt was Ruby Chow. She had an amazing restaurant in Seattle. And besides that, my family has always appreciated food. So it's always been a very big part of my upbringing. But meat especially, you know, my father always had a T-bone steak on the table. My mom grew up bouncing back and forth between Taipei and Oxford. So I, you know, that's where my affinity for that cuisine comes from. We've never been a huge like vegetable forward family. I think when I was a kid, my mom wasn't the greatest cook. She like boiled vegetables till they were just brown and revolting. So it's probably attributes to my distaste for them today. I had a completely different life before this. I was in the business world, which, you know, definitely serves me well now that I own my own business. But I had a completely different career, wasn't happy doing it, even though it was, you know, on paper quite good. But left my job, traveled a lot, and when I was in Spain, realized that I should actually be cooking. And it was when I was there that I just said, you know, forget it, let's just take the leap and do it. So I came back to the States. I, you know, had pretty much spent almost all of my money on travel, but I dumped whatever else I had into culinary school and moved to New York. Anybody that says that cooking is art is, I vastly disagree with, because cooking is a craft. It's something that it takes time to build skill, and what I love about it is that we learn every day. I'm still learning. I'm still learning new techniques and you know, new things and coming up with new ideas. And that's what I love about this industry, is that we are always learning. One of the great things I think that we do very well here at the Beatrice, and just with the way we cook, is I don't put anything on my menu that I don't love 110%. You know, there is so much thought and passion and soul in every dish that is on my menu. And I think that's tremendously special. I think that where a lot of restaurants and chefs go wrong is they try and be everything to everybody. And that's not what I try to do at all, because for me, I think that food can be seasoned perfectly, it can be executed well, it can look beautiful, but if there's no soul and no story behind that dish, then no matter what, it's never going to be as good as it could be, which is why I'm so adamant about only cooking the things that I really love to eat. And there's not one thing on my menu that I don't really love, and I won't get behind 110%. And what I mean by that is that it's not like I have a pasta dish on my menu just to satiate somebody who's going to come into my restaurant. I don't do pasta. I don't do vegetables. I don't do cooked fish. And that's because these aren't the things that I really love or I'm really passionate about. We cook meat here. You know, we cook meat, and we cook all different kinds of meat because it's what I'm tremendously passionate about. It's what I love to eat. And if we can give a little bit of ourselves and have people eat our food the way we want it to be eaten and have them have this really great experience through our vision and through our eyes, that's all I could ever ask for. But I think that for me, my food isn't really meant to pamper or placate. It's meant to be experienced, and it's meant to be eaten with abandon. You know, I think it's still a little bit surreal, but it's such an honor. It truly is an honor to be named with the other chefs that have been named and to be a part of the Food and Wine family now. It's really, really, truly humbling. I think that it's such a great honor to have been named by Food and Wine. And realistically, it's, you know, I'm going to keep doing what I do best, which is just being in the kitchen every day and cooking and hopefully providing people with amazing experiences. You know, I always say that everything starts around a dinner table, and my best experiences and memories and friendships and relationships, they've all started around a dinner table. And, you know, if I can continue to provide these experiences for other people and they can come and have some of their best experiences and memories and relationships start around one of my dinner tables, then that's all I really want.
Angie Marr was named one of the top 10 2017 Best New Chefs of this year's Food and Wine Classic. She will be under the Grand Tasting Tent on Saturday preparing her specialty, meat. When we think of meat, it's hard not to think about the environmental impact that it has. Like, recent studies say that going vegetarian or even vegan allows for the major reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The Food and Wine Classic has events dedicated to meat, like Heritage Fire. Robert McEwen is communications director for Cochon 555, a multi-city culinary competition. Heritage Fire is a spinoff to the event. He joins me now. What is Cochon 555's mission?
Cochon 555 basically exists for one reason: to make people aware of and let them experience heritage breed pigs raised on family farms.
Tell me a little bit more about that mission.
Well, there's two parts to it. One, raising awareness, just getting people to actually taste how different an animal that spends its life in the sun, that eats a special mix. It could be leftover wheat and stuff from a brewery like they do in San Francisco. They could be finished with chestnuts. They could be finished with peanuts as they do in the South. It's just so different in terms of its flavor and its development. The second part is supporting these farmers, both through connecting them to chefs and opportunities to sell their animals, and now through a charity we founded called Piggy Bank to support them through knowledge sharing and soon the sharing of free genetics.
How local is this really?
Well, in every city, that's what's kind of neat about what we do. In every city, the event reinvents itself, because in every city, the farmers are different. The climate is different, so the farmers have to make a different choice of what breed to use. When the breeds are different, the nature of the meat is different. when the nature of the meat is different, what the chefs are going to do with it is different, and the impact is different as well.
What does that collaboration look like between Cochon 555 and local farmers?
Well, I mean, the first part is simply reach out. The second part is bringing them into the system. Sometimes it's helping connect them to farmers, and normally that results in business. Just one restaurant committing to a farmer and committing to a few animals a month can have an enormous impact in the tens of percentage points on their business. The second portion could be something as simple as when a farmer emails us and say, hey, I have no idea, how do you do a website? Like, do I need photos? Do you have photos I can use? I mean, there's an isolation to the nature of farming that really kind of necessitates having some outside support. And that's what we aim to do with ourselves and with the charity.
And what does that collaboration look like specific to Aspen?
Well, I mean, just as early, when we started the event in Denver, I forget how many years ago, and started in Aspen, it was a struggle to find even one or two farms which raised these types of animals, not just as pigs, but as other animals as well, whether lambs or goats or ducks. And now there's a dozen, if not more, if not two dozen farms that are doing this. And this continues to keep growing. And as the restaurant scene keeps growing, and I think, you know, a new restaurant opens in Denver like once or twice a week, or, you know, and probably once or twice a month up in Aspen. And, you know, they're looking for this type of product. It's the growth tends to have a multiplier effect on that.
For folks that believe that meat production is a big contributor to climate change, you know, how does Cochon 555 consider its carbon footprint and educate the community on what it's doing?
Well, this type of farming is the exact type of farming that was erased in the industrial age. So what we're talking about isn't the new type of farming that maybe is connected to certain types of fuels or oils and government subsidies. This is the reverse. This is the way of life, the sustainable, humane, sometimes biodynamic way of life that existed in past centuries in the 1700s, 1800s, early 1900s. So this is precisely the type of farming you should be looking to support.
How is it sustainable?
A lot of these farms, like I said, aren't just... Some of them are organic, some of them are almost fully biodynamic, which means the farms have a life of their own. Maybe they'll have to look one other place. They won't have enough compost one farm, or they won't have enough manure another farm. But for the most part, these farms work within their own ecosystem, and they work within the balance there. So the nutrients come from one part of the farm or grazing pasture, or go into the feed of another. Crops are intercropped to create kind of responsible formations of crops, whether it's a certain herb with a certain vegetable or vice versa. And the these animals pretty much spend their whole life outdoors and free range and eating what they want and growing up with freedom, essentially. And that has a real impact on how different the meat is as well.
Heritage Fire is obviously a popular event. What's new with it this year?
Well, this year we decided to make the focus almost 100% local. So Aspen Food and Wine is obviously a legendary festival. Lots of celebrities, lots of people in from different markets. And what we're doing is almost the opposite. Almost all the farmers are from Colorado. And if not, you know, very, very close by, one of the next two or three states. 90-something% of the chefs are from Colorado as well. So you're talking about a local event, cooked local, farmed local, and executed local. And that's a pretty special thing, especially with something of this scale.
And what is this rustic grind portion of it?
So rustic grind was something we came up with to have the local community have something to do the night before. It's our version of a live music and grill out, except the people grilling it are some of the most interesting chefs in Colorado, and the meats are coming from the same type of sustainable farms as well, and there will be live reggae to boot.
And what do you want people to take away from this event in relation to all of Food and Wine?
Well, I think the simplicity of it and also the connectivity of it, how what you eat relates to the place you're at, and how even the simplest method can have so much behind it, whether culturally or in the name of cuisine or in the name of people as well.
Robert McEwen, Communications Director for Cochon 555. For more information on Heritage Fire, visit cochon555.com. But before Heritage Fire turns up the heat on Fannie Hill Saturday, DC-based reggae funk band CI continues the Snowmass Free concert series Thursday. The band is made up of brothers Arthur Roots Steele and Archie Zebo Steele. This is their song, Never Give Up, and it goes out to their late mother.
To me, what makes my music special is it has a relationship with my life and with the people that's in my life. Never give up, never give up. The name Never Give Up was her message to us that, you know, if you really want to do something in life, you have to really put your mind to it. You have to kind of commit yourself. So it was a song inspired by my mom. So in that sense, it was like a legacy type thing that goes way back to childhood. Love, unconditional. She loved me forever like the great dawn above me. I hadn't even gotten used to my mom being gone. You know, a lot of times you have feelings about something. Like, the feelings about my mom's ain't going to never go nowhere. Because if you lose your mom, it's something that person said, well, you're going to get over it. You probably won't get over it. You probably will learn to deal with it, but you probably won't get over it. She taught us to be men so we can cope and deal in this Babylon world, and now we are made of steel. And every time I wake up, I have to give thanks and pray for another day. It's not one of the songs on the CD that was planned, and like I was in the studio, I was writing these lyrics, and I guess I was missing my mom's and so forth like that. It just came natural. I've been around my brother for, you know, all my life, but just for us to come in the studio and, or not really in my room, I should say, and do that, and it's like, we didn't talk about it. We didn't say, well, I'm going to sing this, and you probably should sing something like this. It just kind of, it happened so natural. It's a perspective of music that I think comes from us being children and actually vibing music as being a language that we related to people with. She came into my life and took the clouds away. You know she made my day. And now I have a wife and a little baby. So I never give up. You know I never give up.
Funk reggae group CI will be playing shows throughout Colorado this week, stopping in Aspen June 15th. For more information, visit stayaspensnowmass.com. Here's what else is happening this week in the arts. Thursday, the Ancor Logos Gallery presents the exhibition America at Heart. It's the West, Honey, starting at 5 p.m. The group exhibition celebrates the rugged individualism of the Western frontier, featuring works by local and national award-winning artists. The 120th Annual Strawberry Days Festival begins Friday and will run through the weekend at Sayre Park in Glenwood Springs. After the parade down Grand Avenue on Sunday, free strawberries and ice cream will be served. Explore Booksellers presents author and photographer Robert Castellino at the Pitkin County Library Friday at 6 p.m. He'll be discussing and signing copies of his book, Colorado, Life and Light on the Land. Additionally, Carbondale Arts will present its first salon in Carbondale at the launch pad Friday at 6 p.m. The salon is modeled after those 19th century European salons and will feature a variety of artistic performances. Thunder River Theatre Company's production of the play The Memory of Water will officially open on June 16th at 7:30 p.m. following a preview June 14th. For additional showtimes, visit thunderrivertheatre.com. And at 8 p.m. on Friday, the Aspen Art Museum presents an evening of artist films featuring works by Wade Guyton, Peter Fishley, and David Weiss, who will also be featured in a museum-wide exhibit opening June 22nd. That's all that's curated this week. For more on arts and culture, tune into Morning Edition throughout the week from 6 to 9 a.m. and visit us at aspenpublicradio.org, where all episodes of this show live. I produced today's show with help from Kristen Kay. It was edited by both Carolyn Zachariasen and Allison Bechtesh. Greg Lau and Jason Patton of Boulder wrote the show's theme tune, Omnicord Entrance. Special thanks to the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, which aims to support the arts, community, and outreach. Continue to follow Curated APR on Facebook for news and updates on arts in the Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.